Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Opinions expressed on the First Coast Connect Week in Review are those of our panelists and do not reflect the views of WJCT News 89.9.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our First Coast Week in Review. And there's a lot to discuss, including a pension comeback for first responders as the city agrees to restore traditional benefits, despite the cost, a council vote to split the community benefits part of the stadium deal into two, $70 million in local arts funding falling to the governor's veto pen, a teacher who was removed after flying a Black Lives Matter flag will keep her teacher license, and parents are suing to keep books on school shelves. To talk about all that and more, I'm joined by Nate Monroe, Metro columnist at the Florida Times Union. Good morning, Nate. I see you, but I don't hear you, Nate.
There we go.
Good morning, Ann. Thanks for being here. Nate's joining us, obviously, via video, but here in studio, I'm joined by Sylvia Perry, editor of the Jacksonville Free Press. Good morning, Sylvia.
Good morning, Ann. Thank you.
Dan Scanlon, WJCT News reporter. Hey, Dan.
Good morning.
And Jacksonville Business Journal editor Tim Gibbons.
Good to be here.
Good to have you. So, Tim, let's start with this. The council voting to shave off most of the proposed match deal between the Jags and the city. This is this big community benefits agreement, a $300 deal in all, with the city chipping in half. And now that money has also been split.
Money has been split out. It's an interesting sort of situation that almost feels performative. The idea that you have this massive deal for the stadium, and the bit that all of the angst is around is, but should we help parks? Should we do stuff for affordable housing? That's become the sticking point. It's kind of weird. I'm sure Nate will have thoughts on this, but the other bit of that being one of the reasons they broke it out was because of the council members who would have conflicts in voting for it. BSA would be looking to receive some of the money, which is a odd way to govern. If you look at the surveys that have been done, voters really like the community benefits agreement. It actually pushed support for the entire stadium project, you know, over a majority of people. So it's a strange move, but there is a sense that they hope to bring it back at some point.
The conflict issue is interesting, though, Tim, because city council members are basically saying, in the event that some of this money could go towards some, you know, homeless, for instance, initiatives, and I potentially could vie for some of that money for the nonprofit or via the nonprofit that I work for, therefore, in some future context, perhaps I would be conflicted, therefore I don't want to vote on this.
Right, which is admirable in a sense, I guess. The idea that if you're saying you do not want to vote, if the stadium deal includes the community benefit agreement, you don't want to vote on the entire thing since you're voting to appropriate money that eventually could get to you, which is a good thing to not have conflicts of interest. But again, the community benefits agreement is such a small part of the overall deal. And even the money that's been broken out is such a small part of the overall deal. It seems like there's a lot of, angst going on over something that is not actually the main thing that you would think would be the discussion.
And yet, Sylvia, the community benefits agreement, as Tim says, was very popular. A lot of people showed up to express their desire to keep it. A lot of people showed up wearing Audi's shirts in orange. And their request to keep this intact and part of the main deal was not something that the council ultimately decided to do.
No, not at this time, due to under the warrants of hoping that they can reinforce it and put more teeth into it. But historically, that community, you think back to the days of consolidation, we have people in Jacksonville still waiting on septic tanks based on agreements the city has done. So they do not want to be left out. And I know the city does not want to leave the Audi's community out as well, because that is the community you'll drive through. Many people, as they come to the stadium, they don't want to see the blight. They don't want to see homelessness. They don't want to see any of that. So it's time for all parties to come to the table and make it happen.
So what is the community response going to be when this decision is made to basically delay that big chunk of funding that would go out east, that would go for some of those initiatives?
It's already been made. Mm-hmm. The decision has basically already been made, and we're in a sit and wait capacity and just hoping that it will be done. But I can just about put money on it that the new stadium will not be up, surrounded by blight.
Mm-hmm. Dan?
I'm just amazed. You're right. And people drive, literally drive down A. Philip Randolph to get to the stadium. That should be a place where, before and after the game, there are places to go to hang out, and not just parking lots for tailgaters. There's a lot of empty lots there. There's been fires there. Homeless people have lived in some of the homes and set fires. I've covered a few of them. It is not a nice thing to be right across an overpass and have only one or two really nice facilities left and a laundromat. The fact that it's being pushed away, though, some council members say they've had years, the folks working on the deal have had years to talk about this. We have a few weeks. We need more time. I understand that. But obviously, don't forget those people who need this money, and don't forget the contractors, the local contractors who want the job to build this stuff.
Nate, we did see some local business, some unions weigh in saying that this was also important from, you know, their view from an economic standpoint, not just from a community benefit standpoint for the people who live in the area surrounding the stadium. But what do you think is at work in terms of this delay vote?
Yeah, I mean, I have found the discussion about the community benefits agreement very perplexing and frustrating from the very beginning. It feels like there is a lot of performative outrage and concern about city spending around this CBA, which, as Tim noted, is the smallest part of this stadium agreement. It's the only part of the stadium agreement that does not like directly inure financial benefit to a billionaire. It's the one part of the agreement that directly benefits the community. And it is the most popular by far portion of the agreement. And yet it is the portion that has gotten all of this acrimony surrounding it. And it just, as I said, it feels performative. It feels political. It feels like there are Republican members of the city council that cannot simply give a Democratic mayor a clean vote. And so I think this delay, and it looks like the administration sort of capitulated to a weird compromise for reasons that I do not understand. It's perplexing. It's genuinely odd to me.
I would say the city council president, Ron Salem, has said, you know, his goal is to examine this chunk of spending more closely and do it during the budget process so that they're not giving a kind of, you know, blank check or, you know, allowing spending without giving it a little bit more of a rigorous assessment. What do you make of that contention or his argument on that front?
I mean, again, you're delaying the smallest part of the agreement to get more time to vet it. But like the $775 million part of it, you're okay voting on in a few weeks. Like, it just doesn't, I just don't buy that. I mean, the city allocates money for priorities. And then once the money's allocated, figures out kind of specific ways of spending it all the time. That's how the city does this. And the council knows that. If they want to take more time to vote on it, I guess whatever. But typically, when you delay voting on something, it means that that something is going to change. It doesn't mean I want to take this up at budget so we can vote on it exactly as it is today. And that is, I suspect that the remaining portion of this CBA is going to change during the budget process.
So, Tim, what about that? I mean, in your experience, does a delay mean diminishment? Will this money that, and the mayor has said that she wants this money to match the Jaguars because it would be a real forceful first investment that would happen very quickly. And then the Jaguars sort of money over time would be used to sustain that investment. But she wants to kind of have a dynamic, very quick transformation with that,
right,
with that funding.
That is an issue. If it gets spread out too much, it doesn't have the impact that there is a value into putting a lot of money in upfront. One of the interesting things on the oversight piece is Business Journal got some public records on the negotiation of the CBA. And in the earlier part of that, there was actually a plan to have a whole oversight set up as part of the legislation, that they would have a board that tracks the money and does all of that. And based on the conversations and the records, it seems that the mayor's office pulled back from that to give council some leeway, rather than saying, here's a plan with, you know, every screw tightened, give council some ability to say, here's how we will provide oversight. I don't know if the mayor's office thought that that sense of oversight would have it get totally pushed out, but there is it's a good thing that council is wants to think about how this money is spent. But I think that was something that was part of the agreement in its early stages, and it was felt, well, no, that's council's prerogative.
And Nate said he was a little perplexed, Tim, by the decision to pull this out and to, you know, kind of do it under the guise of this conflict. You said that you think that that's a little perplexing as well.
I think it's the phrase you just used, you know, under the guise of. And I'm not saying that any of the council people who are leaning this way are doing anything wrong, but the idea that they are not willing to do their job as council people and vote on something because they have conflicts it just feels weird.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any sense?
And can I just add something here?
Yeah.
Just to dwell on that point for a minute, that there are apparently council members who have conflicts and they have conflicts because they are not willing to just not pursue public money. Like I have a hard time believing that if a couple of these council members who run or are employed by nonprofits that are eligible for this funding, if they got statements from those organizations saying that they would not try to get a piece of CBA money, they would not have a conflict. So, but that's not happening. And I think it's just worth kind of dwelling on that for a moment. I mean, I have been writing about this problem for a few years now, city funding going to nonprofits that are run or employ council members. This is a distasteful practice that shouldn't be happening in the first place. And while these council members are acknowledging conflicts, and can recuse themselves, that's recusing doesn't resolve a conflict. It acknowledges that one exists. But, you know, we have seen time and again that council members do not like questioning their colleagues. They don't like to make their colleagues feel uncomfortable. And so this stuff largely kind of goes unscrutinized by the city council itself. And it's because that conflict exists. And anyway, I just wanted to take a moment to dwell
to that point. The idea that they had to pull this out because of the conflicts is a sign that recusal or acknowledging it is not enough, because if it was, they could have just done business as usual.
And what about the fact that 7 council members did not take that vote yesterday?
Which is a crazy high number.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's 40% of the council that doesn't weigh in on this.
And they were aware this was happening. This has been posted for a long time. We've certainly known about it as media. I was there for the 11 o'clock news conference on something else out front, and it was a busy bit of traffic in and out.
We've got a call. Mark, good morning. Go ahead.
2 quick things. Just want to remind everybody that a couple of months ago when the University of Florida study came out about the support for the $1 billion, that the support for the city giving Shadcon $1 billion, it fell way under 50% if you took away the Eastside money grab. And also, I was looking at the breakdown of the budget of all those things from the Times Union the other day, and there seems to be about $14 million that are going to be divvied up to each and every city councilman, and I haven't heard any mention of that. I mean, it sounds like a straight-on bribe.
Interesting comment, Mark. I know that we used to, the columnist Little Page used to call those lollipops for the
council. And this has happened before. We've had council members getting X amount out of budgets for parks and stuff. So it's just a different name for it.
Well, yeah. And it certainly is a way to build some goodwill and consensus. We also have a call from Herman. Good morning, Herman. Go ahead.
Good morning, Ann. Thanks for taking my call real quick. And I hope Nate and especially everyone in the media pushes this. When we initially started this, especially with the huddles and everything, the NFL, according to the mayor in those meetings, were not going to look at this agreement until October. Again, the NFL owners are not going to meet until October. Then there came conversation that this was Ron Salem's pet project. He wanted it done on his watch. Question 1, why did it have to get done on his watch? And if the NFL organization is not going to look at this agreement until October, why is it being fast-paced? So if we can wait till July when they get back for the CBA, we can work and wait till July, get this done by August. It'll be ready by October.
Thanks, Herman. I appreciate it. I know that in talking to Ron Salem, he's kind of said that he thinks that once they start on the budget, that's going to consume all their energy. It is a very intensive process once they get into the budget season. And I think he also probably hopes to have it under his watch that this passes. But there is something to be said for that, Tim. It is a busy time once they fully get into budget season.
It's a busy time. And I'm pretty sure that if you ask the mayor's office, they would be quite happy with the idea of getting this signed and done and through. You look at any big ticket sort of thing, there's a value in oversight. There's a value in it being vetted. There's a value in going through everything. But as this conversation shows, I mean, they're making little tweaks to, you know, the Daly's Place, you know, parking stuff. It's like there's no substantive issues being raised. So why not they're going to give them the money. Just vote for it. Just do it.
Tom on Facebook says, this is a horrible failure by the council to represent the citizens of Jacksonville. The supporters of the community benefit agreement literally filled the council chamber for hearing the measure, yet their voices were not listened to. Once again, the council ignored the voice of the people. We also have a call from Omar in Duval County. Good morning, Omar. Go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you. A while ago, there was a gentleman who stood up in a city council meeting when they were talking about putting the statues back. And he said it's about supremacy. So I believe that the city council, none of them stood up and said anything, maybe one person. So I believe that the city council is asserting their supremacy now. That's my comment.
Thanks, Omar. So going ahead, we do know that there's going to be some additional discussion about this. Sylvia, I remember, we did have some involvement from the International Association of Sheet Metal, Air Rail Transportation Workers, the union very much getting up and saying, you know, we'd like to see this for our community. It kind of reminded me of the debates over the Better Jacksonville plan, because at the time there was this big promise by the administration, then Mayor John Delaney, that there was going to be, you know, this was going to benefit the community, particularly small businesses, and particularly at the time, minority-owned businesses. But there was pushback from the local builders. It went even to, you know, multiple court challenges, and ultimately kind of led to a reversal of minority rules in terms of contracting. It kind of went to a small business definition, but away from something that was more explicitly inclusive of people based on being a racial minority. And I'm curious if this is something that, you know, is a retread of that, if people are concerned about being excluded.
I really don't think that the whole delay has anything to do with that. I think it definitely has more to do with that conflict of interest and trying to define that. Everybody knows elections will be coming up soon enough, and nobody wants to have that throwback of, well, you did this and you did that. I can tell you, I know Jacoby Pittman is a very good friend of mine. She works for the council. She works for the people. And as you said, I mean, it's she would not be doing her day job if she did not pursue a piece of that money for homelessness and XYZ. So they definitely need to put teeth in it. These people want to retain their jobs, represent their constituents as well, and keep it moving.
Yeah, we should say Jacoby runs the Clara White Mission, and is also a city council member. Yeah.
On that JSEB, the Jacksonville Small and Emerging Businesses Program that you brought up, it is interesting that it does seem that the city is ramping that back up in a way that I haven't seen since the Better Jacksonville days. That history of the program kind of got kneecapped during Better Jacksonville, where a lot of small and minority contractors did expect work. The city's putting resources and actually trying to stand that program back up in a way that in talking to small businesses might actually have benefits. And part of that is tied to the stadium, where they have particular programs trying to get small businesses to get some of those contracts. So it is something that at the Business Journal, we very much are, you know, keeping an eye on of how will these small businesses benefit from all of these programs.
Very interesting. Well, it'll be something to keep an eye on. We are talking about the week's biggest headlines with our panel of journalists. I'm joined by Sylvia Perry, Dan Scanlon, Nate Monroe, and Tim Gibbons. You can join our conversation at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjcd.org, or you can reach out on social media. You can also watch our live stream right now if you care to. It's on YouTube and Facebook. But let's shift now to the issue of pensions and possibly pension unreform. So 7 years ago, we heard all about the bankrupt system, the need to overhaul it. We were pushing all of our employees into our city, you know, first responders, particularly into 401k programs. Nate, voters had to weigh in on this. Now it's changing. I'm curious is if you see this as a practical necessity or a political one.
You know, the fact that pensions are coming back is both something that was predictable and was predicted, but is also still kind of stunning, given, as you kind of referenced there, the rhetoric that was used several years ago to sell us on a version of pension reform that was supposed to get rid of pensions. You know, the former mayor talked about pensions being dinosaurs, and it's sort of like, much like consolidation, when the city and county consolidated, there was this expectation that we were like on the forefront of this big change and everyone was going to see what we did and follow us, and like nobody did. And pension reform is kind of the same thing. You know, the lack of a pension plan in public service jobs, and particularly in public safety jobs, is a recruitment and retention issue. So I think on some level, it's probably a practical necessity. It's probably the right policy call to bring some form of a pension back. I mean, the fact of the matter is Jacksonville is one of the only cities of any significant size in America that doesn't offer pensions to its employees. And so I think on that level, it was practical. You know, politically, it's interesting. The mayor certainly ran and said that she was open to considering enrolling employees in the Florida retirement system, which is kind of the state pension system. But she didn't make any promises, and she didn't have support from the public safety unions in her campaign. Quite the contrary, the FOP is one of the more partisan unions just across the country, and it tends to be a very right-leaning union. So politically, we're seeing some kind of strange bedfellows here, and I'm curious in 3 years if this mayor, after restoring pensions, is going to be accused during her reelection campaign of like wanting to defund the police. She is very much doing the opposite of that, to a degree that one of her great fiscal legacies is going to be adding police and really expanding the budget of JSO because of these changes.
Because this isn't just a pension change. This also is a deal that comes with really significant pay raises for first responders, 22% over a couple of years. Is that right?
That's right. And I believe under the collective bargaining agreement that's being negotiated now, starting pay for at JSO is going to be in like the mid-60s, which is huge. That's certainly a lot higher than the median income in Duval County. One of her legacies is going to be funding police at really high levels.
Tim, I want to ask you about the overall cost, because I don't know who is or whether anyone is doing that full analysis. I mean, Nate has reported that the switch over to the 401k itself was not inexpensive. It was a big shift. It required a lot of moving parts. The city also made a very large contribution, 25% of an individual's salary annually to the 401k, which is a lot more than most matches that you see in the private sector. So it was not inexpensive. I'm guessing it won't be inexpensive to once again make a change. And of course, there's a lot of costs that come with pensions, even at the state level.
The change from pensions to a 401k has an expense that changing from 401k to a pension does not. So pension accounting is actually fascinating. And part of it, for certain values, are fascinating. Okay, sure.
Speaking as the editor of Jacksonville Business Journal.
But the idea that basically, I mean, just to simplify it, when they took all of the people and said we're closing the pension, they still owe all of that money, obviously. They don't owe the money now. They owe enough money in the pot to be able to pay off those pensions in the future. And this is the root of all pension problems. No city, no state really wants to put enough money into the kitty at the beginning to be able to pay off in the future. Jacksonville had a string of city councils who kept on increasing pension benefits, particularly for police and fire. Increasing those benefits, it was great for recruitment. It was great for if you were a, you know, a first responder, but once the stock market fell, that bill came due, the city is in a hole. That's what led to the crisis, is because of overpromising the pensions in the first place. So it's going to be interesting to see this as they're promising again. I think that Nate's right. It is a recruiting thing. I think the city does need to offer something like this if it's going to hire these people. But it will be interesting 10 years from now when we're talking about, okay, let's change this again, because it feels like there's a sustainability issue that the city can't get its head wrapped around.
Sure. And Dan, it's no accident that the mayor referred to pensions as dinosaurs. Certainly in the private sector, they have been phased out almost entirely because they are often seen as unsustainable.
And indeed, let's not even forget the fact that A, our grandchildren are going to be paying for this, and B, what's the other big elephant on the table is a new jail and maybe even a new sheriff's office. So that's extra billions of dollars for first responders that must be paid somewhere in the future along with the pension costs. And I'm not saying those are not necessary. If you've been in the jail or the sheriff's office, they are dinosaurs. They desperately need to be fixed, but it's just extra billions on top of paying for all that pension cost in the future.
I got scared when you said that the next elephant, because I'm like, wait, are they buying an elephant now? I mean, the city just keeps
showing
money out.
The sheriff's office was called a white elephant, and that there is a rumor that actually happened. Someone towed a white elephant statue in the 70s and parked it in front of the sheriff's office to show that it was a white elephant when it was built.
Sylvia, I think what's interesting about this is it was not unknown that this was going to lead to recruitment problems. It was very much discussed in reviews of what's going to happen, what are we going to do to solve the pension problem. One of the things that was always brought up, and not just by police and fire, but by people who worked for the city and people who did analysis, was this is going to hurt recruitment and retention. And now it is.
Absolutely. The sad part, too, is that it appears to be a problem that each administration just kind of pays it forward on. And the city will not see any relief until 2030. So it's another 7 years of survivability that needs to happen in trying to get these funds as other priorities continue to increase and goals.
Nate, I want to ask you about the issue of correctional officers, because I believe that you've done some reporting how they are categorized not as first responders, but more as city employees, and that bringing them into the pension without bringing the rest of the city employees into the state pension would require some state level machinations.
That's right. And I frankly am not even quite sure what that looks like. I don't know that the city knows what that looks like either. And I think the commitment that's being made right now is that the city is going to try to figure that out. That could be complicated. And I do want to piggyback on a point that Tim made, that he is right that a lot of cities mismanage pensions because they are not willing to invest in them at levels to keep them sustainable. However, the Florida retirement system is generally considered pretty well run, and it's generally been pretty well funded over the last decade plus. But that's because FRS sometimes goes and tells its member cities and counties, hey, we're going to need you to pay up this year, and you have to pay. You know, something that the city is going to be giving up here by enrolling or allowing people to enroll in FRS is a degree of local control. In some ways, that might be a good thing because the city did not manage its pension debt well over time. But when we're told we have to pay up, and there are times where that might be painful, the city's going to have to.
Well, we're talking about the top stories of the week with our panel of journalists. You can reach out and talk to us on air at 904-549-2937. You can also email questions or comments to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Or you can tag us on social media. I'm going to move on to the topic of budget vetoes. The governor signed the budget into law, $116 billion, but there were a significant number of line item vetoes, including some local cuts that were made, cuts that will prevent a medical examiner's office in the St. John's and Putnam County area, a lot of public works projects. But I think that the arts cuts were really sort of the big resounding, you know, alarm, I think, for a lot of people in the world of culture, Tim. This was all statewide, basically all arts and culture funding cut at the state level.
It does feel like a message was being sent. and I cover business. I'm not going to wade into what that message might have been, but it did seem like a move that was intended to convey something. And you look at some of the other cuts. I mean, the First Coast lost out on nursing education. Not entirely sure what message that was supposed to send. I think the state has a well-known nursing shortage. But it's always interesting when you look at that veto list of trying to discern why that program, why did that get cut? And, you know, sometimes it's because it maybe shouldn't have passed the legislature in the first place. And some of them are to me, at least, opaque as to what the reasoning is.
But it's interesting because the state itself, Dan, you know, calculates the value of arts and culture. And they often will say, you know, it brings in this many millions and millions of dollars, this many jobs. Very important to the economy of Florida, very important to the tourist economy of Florida. So there must be a balancing act there.
Well, even here in the First Coast, we have a large number of arts and music venues that are constantly busy. And what impact will this have? I don't know if you're going to the Amp from out of state to see a concert, but I know I've traveled to Orlando to see concerts and go to art events. So I would think this is going to hurt even the intercity tourism, the fact that you get an overnight bed stay because you want to go to something.
Mm-hmm. And Sylvia, the cuts that we're seeing locally, and this is something we're going to be talking about more on the program next week, but names that you would recognize, like the Symphony, the Florida Ballet, the Five and Dime Theater, all kinds of cultural institutions, including the Cultural Council of Jacksonville, all seeing sometimes half of their budget cut, you know, half of their expected budget cut.
Yes. Well, arts and culture have never been a focal point of the DeSantis administration. So, and with him being a sitting duck, this is his time, I think, to strike. It was, in my opinion, more about the bottom line rather than the priorities of the state. We do have some wins, though. You know, Shands Hospital, they get $15 million for health care for the underserved, $5 million for MOSH. And their particular move, HBCUs throughout the state, money for security. We know what happened with the tragedy here in Jacksonville. So there are some wins along with the losses.
Mm-hmm. Nate, is this messaging? What do you make of it? I mean, the governor was, I think, very happy to say that he brought this budget in kind of under budget, less than last year, included some tax cuts. And so, you know, politically, he is presenting what he thinks is a win. I think a lot of people agree with that, you know, in terms of their financial priorities, but it does seem very specific to target all arts and culture.
It does. You know, John Delaney, the former Jacksonville mayor who is a university president now, he has this kind of stock line that he uses when he's defending liberal arts programs. You know, he says that we want to be Athens, not Sparta. You know, we want poets and we want writers and performers in our society. And I've always really liked that line. This administration, I think, is a very Spartan one in more ways than one. And I agree that it's hard to look at a complete line item veto on something this large and not feel like a message is being sent. Some perception that culture is like a threat to this administration or the kind of like political culture that this administration is trying to cultivate in the state of Florida. I would add that the larger list of vetoes, I mean, if you go down the list and like Tim was getting at this, I can't discern any underlying logic or philosophy to it. I mean, some of it's stuff that seems really important that's just getting cut, and the governor's administration has not even tried on any specific level to justify those cuts. It feels to me like he just wanted this cheap talking point about next year's budget being below this year's budget, and he needed to cut $1 billion, and so that's what he did. I mean, it just, in some ways, as targeted as I feel like some of the arts and culture vetoes were, some of this other stuff just feels arbitrary and weird.
Got a call from Taylor in the Beaches. Good morning, Taylor. Go ahead.
Hey, as a very concerned citizen and public employee in a local government here, and I've tried to bring this to the attention of numerous news venues through your own before, state law 112.66 sorry to be very abrupt about that number, but it, in the Florida retirement system and other local governments have adopted this, you have to be 55 to retire. Well, a lot of them have it where, and I don't know if the cities of Jacksonville is currently like this, but you work 30 years, you receive a pension. Well, that's for people 25, 35, 45, 55. The problem is you have people that start there at 18 who are having to do 37 years to receive the exact same benefits that other people are receiving after 20 and 30 years. And to yet, I can't explain or get anybody to explain how that's fair, how that's not discrimination. And I'm just curious if anybody has a comment about that.
Thanks, Taylor. I'll ask around. Anybody have a comment on that?
I don't have a comment, but it does sound like something that's worth looking into. It's been a while since I've dug deep into pensions, but the outlines of what he's saying ring true. So, it's a good question.
All right. We've got a call from Javon. Good morning, Javon. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Good morning. The budget cuts to arts and culture are just another strike in the culture war that's going on in Florida. And one, I would encourage people to donate to the organizations, go out, enjoy a program, buy a ticket, do something to help those organizations that are harmed address the budget shortfall they're facing. But also, let's just vote these people out. This is ongoing when we look at what's happening with our education system around don't say gay, whitewashing Black history, institutionalizing conservative versions of American history. Arts and culture are a bastion for people who are other, who don't fit into the white male conservative version of reality that even a lot of white men don't fit into. So I think it's the time for people to pay attention and connect the dots and see that they're trying to make Florida a increasingly uncomfortable place for people to be in. And the arts is one of the shining lights that makes people feel comfortable, safe expressing themselves. So the best way to fight back is just to be louder and prouder and Blacker and gayer and whatever you are in light of the harm that DeSantis and those who support them are trying to do.
Thanks, Javon. Appreciate your comments. Dan.
Just to focus on one item I did cover this week, the Tim Aucoin Parks Foundation lost $288,000 in a veto that would have gone for handicapped ramps and some other things for their park fitness programs at three parks to be selected among the state, city, and federal park system. Their response is they're going to rewrite the bill, try to find it a better way to write it, and also seek some private funding. So there are possibilities in these vetoes to seek elsewhere, as this gentleman just said, go donate, go fund. And again, maybe the language of the bill, the fund, the parks folks said, maybe the language wasn't correct or said what they needed. But the fact is, here's somebody who needs rehab, who could go to a park, who's in a wheelchair and can't get there because of a $288,000 veto. Mm.
Sylvia, I want to move on now to the case of Amy Donofrio. She's a Duval County teacher, former teacher at Riverside High. She was removed from the classroom after a dispute over a Black Lives Matter flag that she hung. And this case has been basically dragging on since 2021. First of all, catch us up on the latest because there is a decision made on her teaching license.
Yes. Thank you. So in setting the scenario, and the former educator, she's at Riverside High School, formerly Lee High School, named after a Confederate general, longtime, I went there at one point, school in Jacksonville with a 78% Black population, where post-George Floyd, in the height of the quote-unquote Black Lives Matter movement, and in a effort to empower and engage her students, she hung a Black Lives Matter flag. Now, the administration suggested she take it down, but unfortunately for them, there was no procedural process to force her to. In, Jacksonville, not Jacksonville, but the state of Florida is known for so much, including now we're getting into trying to silence people. The Florida Education Commissioner came after her. She lost her job. She sued. She won $300,000. And then they wanted to strip her of her livelihood, which would have disabled her from teaching. But this week, an administrative judge allowed her to keep her license. So sometimes the little guy does win in Florida.
And so basically this Florida Education Practices Commission, they voted unanimously. They agreed with the judge's ruling that Donofrio did nothing wrong by refusing to remove the flag.
Correct. And that's that fine line of church and state of whether or not a teacher is imposing her opinion into a classroom. But it could be a look at national trends. It could be a look at many different things other than a racist act. And this gave way to the governor's Stop Woke and Don't Say Gay. All of this came from this particular case and how our education is viewed.
And another related school issue is this new lawsuit that was filed over the issue of banned books or removed books or books that are being placed on some sort of restriction in public schools. This is a new filing. It says that essentially, Tim, it says that parents don't have a method to challenge book removal, that the law allows for books to be challenged, but then there's no mechanism to allow them to come back, other parents, and say, we want to keep it.
Right. And that's in some ways the root of this entire discussion about banning books is it obviously prioritizes those who might not even have kids in the school who just don't like the existence of a book. And it doesn't necessarily take into account those who want their kids to have those books. And I think that in some ways is the crux of the matter, that it's not teachers versus parents. Oftentimes it's parents versus parents, that they have different things they would like their kids exposed to.
And parents have been driving some book removals, Nate, that have been drawing, again, some unflattering attention to the state. Indian River County School Board just recently voted to remove from the shelves the book that's called Ban This Book. It's kind of written for kids 8 and older, and it has to do with, books being removed from the library and a kid trying to create a secret library so that those books remain available. But a Moms for Liberty complaint led to this, saying that it was inappropriate because it was teaching children to be social justice warriors.
I mean, I don't even know what to say about this kind of stuff anymore. I mean, yes, bad things are bad. This is bad. Banning books is bad. And I feel like that's not a view that at one time was particularly controversial. So, I mean, we're in a moment in public education in the state of Florida that is just... As a parent of a 2-year-old now who has to be thinking about this kind of stuff, it's frightening in some ways and it's very frustrating.
How do you see it playing? I mean, there's 4 Duval County school board seats up, most of them to be resolved in August. Do you see this kind of thing playing a role?
Of course it's going to play a role. I mean, our school board races in Florida are supposed to be nonpartisan. The governor has made it clear that he wishes that were not the case. And he has made a deliberate effort to politicize those races and get involved in those races. And now every school board race in Florida is like this high stakes battle between like a somewhat normal person and like a freakish activist who wants to ban books. And that's also no way to run elections. Like, I don't think it's good to have choices where you feel like there is this kind of high stakes battle every time.
Nate, I'm gonna have to leave it there with you. Thank you, Nate Monroe, Sylvia Perry, Dan Scanlon, and Tim Gibbons. Thanks so much for being here today. Up next, a documentary on the history of black surfing.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Serious injury cases are complex, and civil trial attorneys present the evidence juries need to see and hear. More at waynehogan.law.
Hi, this is Tom Hudson. Every Friday on the Florida Roundup, you can expect discussion, not disinformation.
Hi there, I'm a family therapist.
This is a First Amendment violation.
Revelations, not empty rhetoric.
Today I just found out that I was eligible for $23 a month in food stamps.
And even some surprises.
Dr. Brown, you helped deliver my baby, and I owe you my life.
Wow.
It's the Florida Roundup, Fridays at noon.
Mm-hmm.
this week on Science Friday. Cancer is the leading cause of death in dogs. Luckily, there's a new, very promising vaccine treatment.
A number of dogs have lived 2, 3, or 4 years after receiving our therapy.
There's some new hope for our four-legged friends. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Los Angeles bans the use of cell phones in schools.
It hurts educationally, and it hurts the mental health significantly.
America's top doctor weighs in and says we should treat social media like a pack of cigarettes.
A warning label would help parents to understand these risks.
Plus all the latest from the election campaigns on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. A little surf music to get us going here. There is an award-winning film that's screening tonight that explores the connection between Black history and the joy of surfing. It is screening for free tonight. And one of the panel discussion members that is going to be talking about this film and the issue of surfing and involvement in surfing is Deona Burton. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. Really
so,
excited.
Deona, how did you get into surfing?
Yeah, so I actually was a part of a surf camp that my mom pushed me to get into a couple years ago, and I was really nervous, and I went out there, and I totally wiped out. My face was covered in sand, full of salt water. It was not a good experience, but my mom kept pushing me to keep going, to keep trying, because she was all about me doing things that she didn't have the opportunity to do. Along the way, my mom connected with Gigi Lucas, and eventually I got involved in Surf Your Negra, and just took off from there.
Tell us a little bit about Gigi. I've talked to her in the past, but she's a pretty remarkable lady.
I absolutely agree with that. She's a mentor of mine, like a big sister. And Gigi, definitely taller than me, really long locks, and she rocks this awesome longboard. And when I think of a powerful woman, or when I think of somebody who's breaking the stigma and just going out there and doing her own thing, I think of her. She's been interviewed. You talked about me doing public speaking, but she's been on every platform I can think of, and she really kills the game. And I think with her surfing journey, her getting involved in a sport that she loves, she wanted to see more people that looked like her. So she started Surf Your Negra, and I was honored to collaborate with her, be a part of the camp, even become like a counselor and kind of like a partner with the organization.
And remind us of the mission of Surf Your Negra. What is the goal of it? I mean, it reaches out to kids who maybe otherwise wouldn't have an opportunity or an inclination.
So Surf Your Negra is making sure that any kid anywhere has the opportunity to surf, but with a specific focus on getting Black and brown girls not only in the water, but comfortable on the board.
Mm-hmm. And so you have since then, you have gone on to do a lot of things. I mean, you're a surfer, but you're also an activist. You were a White House honoree. Tell us a little bit about your path after you became a surfer.
Yeah, so I got involved with Surf Your Negra in high school. And, you know, me and my peers, we always say that, you know, the world falls apart when we're trying to grow up. And it's a very funny thing because being the senior class president of Robert E. Lee High School during the name change, you can't forget social action in anything that we do. So Surf Your Negra actually partnered with an organization I founded, SPEAR, which stands for Showing Political Engagement and Responsibility. And we talked about not only the importance of, you know, being out in nature and being keen to the environment, but also knowing what's going on in local politics and how that impacts you, impacts our waterways, and impacts our resources. Because of that, I guess, involvement with Surf Your Negra and her kind of leading me through growing SPEAR, the initiative at the time, upon graduating high school, I went on to college and kept doing what I kept getting involved in social action, joined student government, joined my sorority, eventually became, as you mentioned, a TEDx speaker and a White House honoree, and most recently came back from interning with Congress.
So what's next for you? I mean, you really have done so many extraordinary things, and you seem well poised to move on to some, you know, very impressive futures. What are you interested in next?
Well, currently I'm here in Jacksonville working with the Jacksonville Public Education Fund. As you know, we recently selected a new superintendent, but really working to get the word out there about school board elections and the recent threat of school closures. And through that work with JPEF, I hope to either stay here to keep the good fight going or maybe be back in D.C. shortly.
Mm-hmm. So tonight there's a screening of this film, Wade in the Water, A Journey into Black Surfing and Aquatic Culture. Mm-hmm. The film director will be here, David Mesfin, and you will be part of a panel discussion. What's interesting is that the film traces the history of black surfing back to Western Africa well before, you know, modern times, 1679, as a thing that was done before it was being done in Hawaii, or at least mm-hmm. recorded being done in Hawaii. And yet that has changed. Perceptions of that have changed in terms of, you know, whether people pursue surfing, particularly women of color, and whether that feels like a safe space. So how is that changing in your time? How have you seen that change, or is it changing?
I think it's kind of, the answer there is kind of in the name. As you mentioned, you know, surfing goes back so long, and I think black people specifically, I like to say that we're like a one-stop shop. We can do it all. And with black and brown people not always being seen in spaces that we are a part of, we have to create our own spaces. So coming into the surfing environment under the name of Surfer Negra, I never really felt ostracized or like I wasn't seen because I was surrounded by people that looked like me. But we partner with other organizations and they've been happy to do the work and to have those uncomfortable conversations. So I will absolutely say that it's changing.
Well, Deanna Burton, the screening is tonight at 7:00 in St. Augustine at the Waterworks on San Marco Boulevard. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our program. We encourage you to send your feedback or suggestions to First Coast Connect at wjct.org. If you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast or you can subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to listen Saturday when neurologist Dr. Joe Servin examines the latest updates in Alzheimer's research and treatment options on what's health got to do with it. The executive producer of First Coast Connect is David Luckin. Our show is produced by Stacey Bennett. It's directed by Brady Quorum, and Jamie Villay is our associate producer. Our theme music is performed by Club de Belugas. Join us Monday when we talk to residents suing to stop a new morgue from moving into their neighborhood. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.